Greetings, boys and girls, and thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Mafia Wife Life. Here, you already know it's your girl, a Mafia Wife. I'm not consistent about recording episodes. I know sometimes podcasters, they'll quote drop an episode every Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever. I've never held myself to that type of structure, because, you know, I could if I wanted to, but I really don't want to. I just record episodes if and when I feel like it, if I have something on my mind that I care to express. And sometimes I think, yeah, you know, I gotta remember that. I'll talk about that on an episode. And then life just gets going and, you know, I end up not talking about it on an episode, and because other things have come up, and then sometimes I will circle back. So depending on what has been going on between the previous episode and then this current episode that I'm interested in recording, sometimes I have to go back and I have to look at the transcripts from, you know, the previous episodes, because honestly, once I express it, and this is the magical thing for me, as it pertains to expression, you know, once I express whatever it is I'm interested in expressing, it's out the window, you know, it has flown the coop, as they say, and that is liberating, that is freedom for me. And I think that, you know, that's really always been so. And I think that is why expression is so important, you know, for people, because if there is something on their heart and mind, and they carry it with them, sometimes it can be a lot of weight, you know, and sometimes it's okay to learn how to carry it and just sort of go along. But if you would rather excise it, you know, get it out of you, that's okay too. You know, I think that, that is why, and I know the Godfather understands this, that is why I will go deep, deep down a road of a particular type of creative expression, and I'll get to the point with that particular medium that I'm like, okay, I'm satisfied. You know, I have developed this skill or strategy or challenge as far as I'm interested in. And if I continue, then I'm just sort of doing the same thing. And that's what I'm not interested in. You know, I'm full in as long as I am engaged. And once I've sort of, you know, hit the summit, whatever I define summit to be, it's not like I, you know, fold up my, you know, creativity bag. I just apply it to other, you know, other vessels. But the desire to express, whether it's three-dimensional, one-dimensional, tangible, not tangible, whether it's strictly visual, whether it's, you know, consumption in another, you know, in another way, I'm talking about food here or even music, it doesn't really matter. I just know that there's, you know, there's always going to be something that will capture my spirit and make me want to, you know, hop on for a bit. So going back to the previous episode, I reviewed the notes and I was like, oh yeah, I talked about horseback riding. And of course that's continuing, and it's, you know, it's so satisfying in ways that I never anticipated. It checks boxes that I had no way of knowing I wanted to have checked until I did it. Two things growing up, I know kids always have these ideas of what they think would be great or what they think would be fun. And, you know, I had an opportunity to do a lot of different things, or if I, you know, or make them up or whatever. But I knew I was never getting a trampoline, and I knew I was never getting a horse. But that didn't mean that I didn't try to align with kids that had trampolines or that had horses, you know, because I definitely did that. But I never thought that that was going to be something that I would have myself. And that's totally fine. There's plenty of kids that don't have horses or trampolines, and they end up living a life happily ever after. You know, as an adult, you know, and the mother of four children, you know, that were and are very athletic people, good divers, good cheerleaders, but good in other sports as well. Any sports, really, surfing, skiing, volleyball, track. Trying to think of all the different sports they did. They just did tons. Lacrosse. They were good at the sports that they engaged in. But I knew that they had a fundamental athleticism, and I was happy to, you know, green light a trampoline. But we did our research and found and purchased the, you know, the safest trampoline that was on the market, and with no regrets. But because we lived in the suburbs, it's not like you can, you know, rock up with a horse trailer on your driveway and, you know, have a horse in your backyard. But it was something that, you know, always sort of called to me. And if we were traveling somewhere where trail riding was an option, we always did it. You know, just because the opportunity presented itself and it was like, yes, we are doing that. Let's do it. So we've ridden in so many places, and it's always, you know, given me that feeling that I always sort of connected with, you know, when it came to myself and my, you know, this baseline interest in horses. So, you know, and I know that people have different interests. You know, not all of my girls are interested in riding horses, but one of my daughters specifically, is cut from the same horseback riding cloth that I am, and it has been so fabulous to have had the opportunity to take these lessons, you know, at a nearby farm. And she has two little ones that nap, and that, you know, her littlest has a morning nap, and then he has an afternoon nap as well, as does her. As her older son, of course, they have to have lunch in between. So she is in that quote season of her life where she is bound to, you know, nap schedules, which we've all been there, honey bunnies, and it's really, life is better if you stick to that schedule. So, you know, we've worked it out with Kimmy, our beloved instructor. We meet up at her farm. It's like a 10-minute drive from, you know, from where we live. And Claire has the, you know, she has her lesson first, and I'll walk around with Woods and Reese, or take them on a wagon ride, or, you know, just walk inside the barns and look at the horses and, you know, just whatever while she's having her lesson. And then after her lesson, it'll be my lesson, and she will leave with the boys and, you know, take them home for their lunch and their nap, etc. So, you know, we've both recognized, you know, how fortunate we are that we are able to do this. We are able to do it together, and we're able to do it in a location that is so convenient, and we're so grateful. You know, as a mother, I am particularly grateful because anytime I have an opportunity to spend time with my children, particularly on a one-to-one, you know, I I'm on that, you know, and I'm happy for that. And so that's why I really like doing ordinary things with them, you know, going to the grocery store, going to Target, going on walks around the neighborhood, cooking, you know, and now in this instance, horseback riding. But I don't just get to do this with my daughter. I get to also experience it with my grandsons who like seeing their mommy, you know, on the horse, and it gives them an opportunity to experience being around a barn, being in a farm. But beyond that, you know, I have this extra benefit that I had no way of anticipating. Our instructor, Kimmy, is also, like myself, the mother of four children. One of her children was fatally injured in a car accident a few years ago, which, you know, obviously is very, very challenging, but her faith is so powerful. Every step she takes, she knows that he is with the Lord. But this is a woman that lives her faith. She lives by her belief. She doesn't just, you know, say things that are sort of Christian sound bites. She actually lives, you know, she lives it. And I know of her, you know, from her son, who, you know, who I was introduced to through one of my other daughters. And he was and is a singular-minded person who makes up his own mind, extremely faith-filled, extremely talented, walks the walk too, and does not, you know, doesn't say things just because it sounds good. They live it, you know, and I find that so inspiring. And so let's see, Steve and I, oh, we were in Florida. I mentioned that in the previous podcast. So I had to miss a lesson, and Claire's lesson was rescheduled for the weekend, so her husband could watch the boys, you know, so she wouldn't have to miss a lesson. So what is today? I guess last week when I, you know, when I was back and had my lesson with Claire, I had not only missed the week previous when I was in Florida, I had missed, you know, a couple of weeks prior because of this rotator cuff surgery. So I was on, you know, I was beside the barn with Reese and Woods, and you know, Kimmy was teaching a lesson in the ring, and she had a number of students, and she looks over to me and Claire, and she's like, hey ladies, missed you, so glad you're back. And I yelled over to her, I said, hey Kimmy, oh my gosh, it's so great to be back, missed you too. And I extended my arms as though I was giving her a kind of air hug. And she said, oh no, you can't hug me. She goes, I have shingles. And I was like, what the hell, Kimmy? And, you know, her face instantly turned to stone. And Claire said, Mom, you can't swear. You can't swear. And I was like, oh shit. I said, sorry, Kimmy. I didn't mean to swear. You know, I know you don't like swearing. I just said it, you know. I do swear, but I respect the fact that you don't swear. I'm sorry you have shingles. Sorry, sweetheart. You know, and of course, that's fine. No big deal. But I liked the fact that, you know, she holds on to her position. I don't care if somebody swears or they don't swear. And I'm happy to not swear if I feel like that person is really consistent, but I'm not going to sort of self-edit and second guess what I'm saying before I say it if I think that that's just something that sounds good. But I know that Kimmy lives that. So when it was time for my lesson, I was like, Kimmy, I get where you're coming from, blah, blah, blah. And she said, it's totally fine. And she said something else. And she doesn't hold on to stuff, And I just admire how she, how she lives, and how she really believes, she believes the words that she is saying, and she lives the words that she is saying instead of just saying things. She, and we all know people that say things, they say, oh, they're this or they're that, they believe, they pray every day, they go to church, blah, blah, blah. And these are people that, that they have no forgiveness, whether or not there's something to forgive for. They quote accidentally swear, which is totally fine. I'm not the swearing police, but then they blame it on the other person, saying, you made me swear. That's ridiculous. They make excuses for other people that they want to make excuses for, people that never fucking saw a child when they were here, ever. And so, even though they lived, in their fucking backyard or down the road, and they say, she says, well, they were out of town, or she was busy with sports. Unfortunately, neither are true. If it was true, that would be fine. But it's not true. These people did not see this child because they didn't want to, mostly because this child's parent was supposedly friends of mine. So I'm not going to buy into that. And then there's all this singing and dancing for the things that came afterwards, and like this really exaggerated, puffed up narrative about how so and so always did that, how so and so always did that, and really loved this expression and really loved that. And that was not my experience. And at some point, in my podcast, I will go into detail about that, not because I want to, but because I think it's important. I'm allowed to share my firsthand experience, what I observed in my own homes. Period. We'll put a pin in that for now, but excuse me, I'm parched. Anyway, so I am continuing with my selective memoir reading. And I think, well, I know where I left off the last time. And so, anyway, about Kimmy, what's interesting to me is that I guess she's observing me with my daughter and with my grandsons. I did not fully recognize that, even though I was there, and I'm the one that's watching what's going on in the ring, honey, Kimmy, you're teaching me. And yesterday after lesson, she said, I am going to adopt you as my second mom. And I was like, what? Why would you want to do that? But I realized that she was, identifying the types of, I guess, nurturing and mothering that, was coming out of me, comes out of me naturally. And I thought that was very sweet. I'm used to younger people saying, will you adopt me? No, I am my mother's, my daughter's mother, but that is my job. I am a mother to my children. But I have never had a peer say that to me. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Anyway, it's a good time up at lessons, and I always learn something, and I always learn more than I would have anticipated. And I tell the Godfather, thank you, because it's really the highlight in some ways of our week. And you know, that's what I miss about, you know, my friendship with my mother. She and I used to go out and do really random things together. It didn't matter what it was, but we went out mostly shopping for vintage, but also other things, you know, fabric stores, you know, lighting stores, you know, things that had to do with ordinary living. And it gave us an opportunity to spend time together as peers, as friends, and I certainly learned from her, and I really, really liked that, you know. And you know, it's upsetting to me that I've been, you know, cut off from that, you know, but that's her choice. But I tell the Godfather, you know, I'm happy now that I can give that opportunity to my children, and I am, you know, that I can teach them and they can grow and have the same kind of benefits that I had. So, as it pertains to the memoir, the next part that I'm transitioning toward says, lucky for me. Well, this was after I realized that, you know, I was tired of being afraid of the rain, and I had to just set that down and try to be stronger, you know, and just put that behind me. So I said, what was that last part I read? You know, raindrops keep falling on my head became my new anthem. As far as I was concerned, my scaredy cat days were behind me, miraculously replaced by a new breed of junkyard dog. So beyond that, I say lucky for me, I had a comrade in the form of my sister Mary, 15 months my junior. Mary's fragile constitution had a way of uniting my parents, affording them an opportunity to play doctor and nurse again, a profession my mother had reluctantly abandoned after I was born. Mary's ailments, mostly chronic ear infections and mysterious stomach concerns, connected my parents, who spoke freely across the table at supper about the quality of her bowel movements or the color of fluid that drained from her compromised ears. I had no appetite for such discussion during mealtime, or any time really, though no amount of gagging would get them to stop. My parents enjoyed using their medical vocabularies with one another, and Mary's health challenges gave them the perfect opportunity. Seated in their respective positions at opposite ends of our table, watching them converse in this way was like being a courtside spectator at Wimbledon, my head turning side to side in sync with their verbal volleys. Though I had no understanding of their shared terminology, I had the sense that whatever was going on between them was somehow romantic, even bonding. I wondered if what I was seeing was similar to what other kids observed when they saw their parents holding hands. Dissecting Mary's medical issues, however inflated, connected them and returned them to a place where they first fell in love. Though the Mary I knew had the will of a serpent, my parents' collective lens viewed her as poor Mary, a label that stuck with her for a lifetime. From my vantage point, I didn't see a poor Mary at all, but a lucky one. I envied the candy necklaces, jawbreakers, Charms Pops, and Hershey bars that overflowed from the pink disposable puke bowls she brought home from the hospital, following yet another procedure involving her tonsils or ears. Her collection of stuffed animals and cozy blankets ballooned over time, one poor Mary scenario after another. The final straw came when Mary was given permission to quit the miserable piano lessons we suffered through weekly in the drafty basement of a nearby church. The building was old and creaky and largely empty given our after-school time slot on a weekday afternoon. Beyond a wooden cross and the tuneless piano, there was nothing to indicate that this building was really a church at all. I was suspicious of Mrs. Pring, our ancient instructor, whose odd facial expressions made her appear as though she was constantly trying to remove the taste of vinegar from the surface of her tongue. The remaining strands of her thin white hair were aggressively teased onto the top of her shiny head, made brighter courtesy of the single bulb that hung over our so-called studio. Mrs. Pring made me uncomfortable in the same way that Norma Bates did in Alfred Hitchcock's miserable movie Psycho that I'd seen with my cousins on the sly. Until we were enrolled in Mrs. Pring's program, I wasn't aware that bad music teachers existed. Before our move, Mary and I were fans of the young teacher who came to our house and actually listened when we told her we wanted to play songs by Peter, Paul, and Mary, or Simon and Garfunkel. Mary and I would watch from our living room's picture window, waiting for Karen's Volkswagen Beetle to roll into view. To us, she was the model of cool. Karen showed up in patchwork ponchos and corduroy maxi skirts, carrying songbooks in her oversized suede fringed purse. Her waist-length dark hair, parted in the middle, blew behind her as she made up our driveway in scuffed-up dingo boots. The best thing about Karen was that she was kind. She listened to us and wanted us to love music in the same groovy ways that she did. If there was anyone that could suck the joy out of music, it was Mrs. Pring. Poor Mary made the mistake of asking our new instructor if she could teach us how to play John Denver's new song, Leaving on a Jet Plane, only to experience the frightening spectacle that was Mrs. Pring gathering up every music book within her skinny arm's reach before slamming them down on the keys. Her uninspired methods, including making good use of a thick wooden ruler she kept across her lap during lessons, striking the tops of our hands if our finger placements were just the slightest bit off. Poor posture was not tolerated. Even the most subtle slouch set off another one of her tirades, mostly insults about how lazy and ungrateful we were. No amount of complaining got us out of those lessons until my mother's declaration that Mary's days in Mrs. Pring's dungeon were suddenly over. I lobbied hard for myself, arguing that it wasn't fair that Mary could quit and I couldn't. My stubborn mother held fast, arguing without fanfare that when I got an ulcer, I could quit too. Pause. Parched. Despite my parents' misguided perceptions regarding poor Mary, I was grateful for the iron will that I knew firsthand resided just beneath the surface of her so-called fragile constitution. As roommates, we did our share of fighting. I was obsessively neat. Mary was not. We were the odd couple, Felix and Oscar. She didn't care if her bed was made, if her clothes were put away, or if her shoes lined up in pairs on the floor of our shared closet. My idea of clutter was a single book left on a nightstand. My need for control hadn't disappeared just because I'd let go of the weather. It shifted, is all. Walking into a tidy bedroom, as prim and ordered as the ones I saw on TV, was attainable in ways that outrunning the rain never was. I considered my goal a worthy one, though as hard as I fought for it, Mary fought equally as hard against it. Mostly our fights involved screaming loudly over each other, though often they escalated, and kicking, scratching, and hair-pulling would enter into battle, sometimes ripping our clothes or drawing blood. No one ever won, and Mary's side of the room would remain as messy as ever. Despite how perfectly perfect I tried to make my own. Despite our differences, though, unless we were fighting, we were friends. Mary and I were allies, compatriots, and definitely each other's ride or die. Like me, Mary didn't like it when we got more than our fair share of chores dumped on us. For whatever reason, our older sister wasn't saddled with the same kinds of heavy loads that we were. Anne was our parents' firstborn, so treasured that my mother liked to say that her and my father used to wake her up when she was sleeping, just so they could play with her. There were countless photos of her in their early albums, doing one precocious thing after another. My parents' favorite was a shot of her peeking around a corner, blue eyes wide, saying she'd just seen an angel. Anne's arrival coincided with a genuine sweet spot for the young Dr. and Mrs. Jerome Davis Gorman. Living in Baltimore, only an hour from her parents, from her family in Harrisburg, my mother was working as my father's nurse in a small practice. They were playing doctor and nurse for real. Following Anne's birth in January, 16 months after saying I do, the young professionals happily brought their bundle of joy to work with them, using a blanket-lined drawer as a makeshift cradle. My mother was happy, beginning her happily ever after. 15 months later, I crashed the party, and their honeymoon was over. For much of their marriage, geography remained a steady challenge for my parents. Born and raised in Pennsylvania, my mother was close to her family and enjoyed the four seasons, particularly the cold, snowy winter she grew up with. My father, a native Floridian, was drawn to the Sunshine State, where his parents and siblings resided. When their respective families began to expand, adding cousins, in-laws, nieces, and nephews into the fold, the drumbeats coming from their opposing sides of the Mason-Dixon grew louder. Neither of them wanted to be uncomfortably far from their families of origin, but it wasn't possible to shrink the distance of over the 1,000 miles that existed between the two locales. Even finding a suitable halfway point required a travel distance of 500 miles in either direction. Granny blamed my mother for taking her son out of Florida, an accusation not without merit. While it's true that my mother hated Florida for its muggy heat, crunchy grass, and relentless sunshine, it was more the impossible distance it put between her and her loved ones up north. Air travel wasn't as accessible in the way as it is now, and long solo car trips with a handful of little ones was daunting in its own way. When my mother did time living in Florida, her beloved Pennsylvania might as well have been the moon. I was born in Dade City, Florida, a small town northeast of Tampa. Fathers weren't allowed in delivery rooms in those days, though given my dad's status as an MD, privileges were dutifully granted. Their obtuse obstetrician must have been absent on the day that bedside manners were taught, because his proclamation regarding my debut was delivered in a bored and dismissive tone. "You have another split tail," he told them, before turning and leaving the room. My arrival was met with none of the fanfare of their firstborn, who showed up earthside on a snowy January day up north. My auspicious beginning was met with all the pomp and circumstance of a helium balloon that hovered midway between the floor and ceiling of a hotel ballroom long after the party was over. It didn't help that I wasn't a boy, or that I arrived in a place that my mother despised. I was a chunky baby, nicknamed Rock of Gibraltar, courtesy one of my aunts. Worse than the heat, the distance, my split tail or size, was the absence of blue in my Irish eyes. I was something my slender and fair-eyed mother didn't seem to recognize or even come to terms with. She was unable to square with this version of her storybook ending. Though it wasn't properly identified, my mother was depressed in those postpartum months, so far from home and the life she imagined. For the time being, in those early months when it really mattered, there was nothing that could pull her back to her former state of contentment. A stocky brown-eyed baby born in the heat of a Florida spring, an impossible distance from home, wasn't what she signed up for when she accepted my father's modest proposal. But there we were. It has been documented that the week of April 14th through the 20th is known as the cruelest week in history. I came into this world, into my family, on the 19th of April, 1962. Events coinciding with the week of my birth include Hitler's birthday, Lincoln's assassination, the burning of Notre Dame, and the sinking of the Titanic. The Columbine shootings, Waco, Oklahoma City bombings, and the Boston Marathon bombings also took place in the span of those particular 7 days. The first shots of the American Revolution were fired, and in 1906, one of the deadliest earthquakes in United States history killed over 3,000 people in San Francisco, destroying 80% of the city. 80,000 animals died, a direct result of the BP oil spill. Earlier in April, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., champion of the civil rights movement, was assassinated in Memphis. My father was working for the Department of Public Health, a position that kept him away from home for much of the week. My parents' early days of working together with their newborn in tow were over. For the first time in her life, my mother's long days were spent mostly alone inside a stifling house in an unfamiliar town, caring for Rock of Gibraltar and a blue-eyed toddler daughter. My arrival, however unintentional, broke up the charmed reverie of their early days. In my mother's wildest imaginings, she never once envisioned herself living more than 1,000 miles from her loved ones, her cherished father, her mother, and her 4 siblings, now with children of their own. Her melancholy, along with my father's restless spirit, was of enough significance that 15 months later, when my new best friend arrived in the form of my newborn sister Mary, it was in Danville, Virginia, another small town, though far closer to my mother's family, an easy 5-hour distance, comfortable enough to traverse in the span of a weekday afternoon. My mother's miserable Florida days were behind her, or so she believed. Mary's poor reputation began in those early days in Danville, suffering one chronic ear infection after another. Her stomach issues, whatever they were, didn't present until later. Her compromised immunities provided my parents with the perfect opportunity to unite again as doctor and nurse, just as they had in the earlier days of their romance. Mary's sickly constitution was the thing that stoked their flames, the thing that kept them bonded to each other and to her. Their lives in Danville improved further still when 19 months later, they had their first son, a boy they named Edward William in honor of both of their fathers. Eddie's arrival felt charged, like there was a new current running through our household somehow. Eddie's birth shook the family snow globe, changing the dynamic of our girl-centric household. That spring, my dad bought a new Chevy, a puffy sedan he called Black Beauty. I admired the red interior, and from the back seat watched as my normally reserved father leaned back on the hood, arms folded across his chest, and talked to the neighbors about the finer points of Black Beauty's engine. I hadn't seen this version of my dad before. Having a son seemed to illuminate a part of his spirit that he'd set aside during those condensed years of one daughter after another. Having a boy awakened the Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer in him, heroes of his youth. My dad was an Eagle Scout and loved certain challenges of the great outdoors. Once Eddie was born, the occasional afternoons I spent fishing with my dad became fewer and farther between. Our sailing excursions in the Sarasota Bay became more abbreviated until finally they stopped happening at all. Maybe my dad grew tired of baiting the hook at the end of my line. I wasn't a talented angler. Mostly I sat at the edge of the splintery dock, cane pole in hands, focusing on the red and white bobber while hoping my flip-flops, dangling over the water, wouldn't fall off of my tender feet. I wasn't the best skipper either, tending to stay put on the small ledge at the front of the boat, swallowed up by the dry-rotted life jacket strapped to my chest. Still, though, to me it was fishing and sailing. Those two activities were the only things I did just with my dad, until at some point, as Eddie went from baby boy to toddler to young boy, I didn't. After Eddie came Donna, my parents' most classically Irish-looking child by a landslide margin. In addition to the bright blue in her eyes, Donna's features included fluffy strawberry blonde curls and a scattering of freckles across the skin of her pale Irish skin face. Though no such pageant officially existed in our family, Donna's prized features catapulted her straight to the winner's circle in the eyes of my judgmental and clannish relatives. So sweet were her features that her nickname, far better than my own, was Lil Puddin. My nickname, courtesy my mother's father, our grandfather Pop, was Brown Eyes. Unfortunately, Donna's physical characteristics weren't enough to gain favor with our mother. Under different circumstances, Donna's physicality alone might have been all that she needed to gain favor with the person she'd been named after. As it was, Donna's downfall, through no fault of her own, was the location and time of her innocent birth. Like me, Donna was born in the heat of a Florida spring, arriving mid-May, just in time for the state's most oppressively hot months of the year. Though happy enough with their life in the metropolis of Danville, my father accepted a position at a hospital in St. Petersburg, a place where my life would forever change once the hurricane hit. It wasn't Donna's fault she was born there. Donna, or Little Donna, as she was known in those days, had nothing to do with my father's decision to accept his new position. But my mother, like so many other women of her time, felt powerless, or at least didn't put her stubborn foot down like she did in coming years when my father announced it was time to pack up and move again. Instead, my disciplined mother seethed quietly, internalizing her feelings of anger and despair. Of my mother's 13 children, Donna and I were the only two born in the state of Florida, a place she despised. Whatever happened or didn't happen in those early months following Donna's arrival happened to me too, born in the dawn of a Florida summer. Like me, Donna wasn't the oldest, she wasn't sickly, and she wasn't a boy. Despite her qualifying features, Donna's appearance wasn't enough to pull my mother back from her enduring melancholy. Though the term baby blues was commonly used in those days, proper identification of what came to be known as postpartum depression wouldn't surface until sometime in the 70s, years after Donna and I were born. Despite their medical training, given their stiff upper lip backgrounds, it's doubtful that my mother or father would have co-signed on such an observation, or worse, in their minds, a medical diagnosis of a psychiatric condition, however transient. The acknowledgement of such a concern, even to themselves, would be considered a sign of weakness or personal failure of some kind. My parents wouldn't allow themselves the indulgence of this kind of self-examination, though I would sometimes overhear them use terms like nervous breakdown when I listened in on their conversations about our neighbors or people they knew from church. I didn't know what a nervous breakdown was or why people had to go away somewhere when they had one. Though I was in possession of a fanciful imagination, my stubborn mind was also literal when it came to certain things, especially things that sounded like they were one thing, but were really another. When I asked my mother what a nervous breakdown was, her answer was typically vague, telling me that it was something that happened when someone needed to go away and rest somewhere. That answer explained nothing, so I pushed further. But how is that a nervous breakdown? I wondered. If it's a nervous breakdown, what happens when it happens? I wanted to know, zeroing in on the words as I had a tendency to do. This time, my mother shrugged and said it's when someone gets really tired and they need to go somewhere and rest. It was a typical non-explanation, but as far as I was going to get, leading me to my default of imagining it instead. Putting the two words together in my drifty, though literal young mind, I constructed a mental picture of what I believed a nervous breakdown must be. Taking the word nervous, I envisioned a person being so nervous that their entire body would suddenly shake from the top of their head all the way down to their feet. I imagined someone's mother, young and pretty like my own, at a grocery store on a weekday afternoon, beginning to shake in that way, keeping a grip on her cart as she continued down the aisle. I pictured her hands shaking so completely that she'd lose her grip and the cart would go rolling off on its own, crashing into a pyramid of apples or mountain of eggs. After the shaking, she'd simply fall over. The breakdown would happen just that fast. I knew there was more to it beyond my mother's rudimentary explanation, but similar to the cartoon-like musings I had of the nut house, this was my childlike understanding. I had no way of knowing that mostly nervous breakdowns didn't happen in the ways I imagined. Now it was more than powerful storms and nut houses that concerned me. Thanks to my anxiety-filled imagination, now I was nervous about nervous breakdowns too, and what would happen to my mother, or where she would go, if suddenly she had one too. Thankfully, my mother's dark days in the Sunshine State were over for good when my father accepted yet another job offer, this time in Cincinnati, Ohio, a Midwestern state next door to her beloved Pennsylvania. Things seemed to gel for my parents in Cincinnati and for us kids too. My dad's new position with the Herx Pharmaceutical Company took him away from us often, but when he was home again, it felt like he was happy to be there. My dad was in and out of time zones, flying back and forth to headquarters in Frankfurt and all over the United States, setting up drug studies and medical schools in pursuit of FDA approval. He began speaking primitive German around the house, saying ja instead of yes and nein rather than no. Sometimes he brought us presents back, mostly children's books written in German, impossible to understand. A new fan of German engineering, he abandoned Black Beauty and started driving a Volkswagen instead. He developed a fascination with the cuckoo clocks made in the Black Forest, and suddenly we had birds chirping on the hour, every hour, in our kitchen and family room. It was suspenseful, watching the clock strike the hour, waiting for the tiny bird to pop out of its Hansel and Gretel-like house. Sometimes I wanted to climb on a stool when no one was looking and pinch it between my fingers so I couldn't go back inside. The bird had a way of startling me, scaring me out of my daydreams. Mostly, I wanted it to just go away, but thanks to my father's new preoccupations, I knew it wasn't going anywhere. My parents went to the movies in Cincinnati and fell in love with Dr. Zhivago, a title my father enjoyed pronouncing in his new thick accent. I'm only going to read a little bit more here because I get very thirsty, I get very parched, and I don't want this podcast to be too long, and I will continue on another episode. But still in Cincinnati, I am saying this: on special occasions, we went to Annette's, a fancy restaurant with white tablecloths and deep red curved leather booths. My dad bought my mother pearl earrings and later a necklace to match. Most prized was her mother's ring, displaying the 7 birthstones of her children set between 2 gold bands. Years later, a second ring would be purchased, required in order to accommodate the final number of stones. My dad bought us kids new bikes and a bicycle built for 2 with a baby seat attached for him and my mom to ride. In Cincinnati, we were living a kind of life that we hadn't lived before. We flew in an airplane for the first time, traveling through the clouds to see our Florida relatives instead of enduring the long, hot, sticky car rides we'd made countless times before. My father's new position required periodic socializing with other doctors and their wives, revealing a side of my parents I hadn't yet seen. On these occasions, my mother wore her new earrings and left our house smelling like perfume. Sometimes, instead of going out, they would entertain at home instead. My mother would cook something out of the ordinary, and the grown-ups would have dinner in the dining room, illuminated by the light of our small chandelier. I enjoyed the pageantry of these evenings, observing what I could from a distance. I liked watching this animated version of my parents, whose eyes appeared to shine brighter, their laughter quicker and louder. Sometimes my father would slap his own thigh, squeezing his eyes shut while laughing at something I couldn't understand. My mother would serve her famous lemon meringue pie, or maybe her pineapple upside-down cake, presented with a flourish on top of the hobnail cake stand they'd received as a wedding gift. Sometimes I'd hear a round of applause coming from the dining room when this happened. At some point, usually after the meal, but before coffee and dessert, our babysitter would let us know that we'd been summoned to the table to say goodnight to the grown-ups. We were paraded out, fresh-faced and scrubbed, just before bedtime in our slippers and robes. In those moments, lined up by age, we were the Von Trapp children in The Sound of Music, a movie both of my parents enjoyed. In these snapshot scenes, my father was the Baron, my mother, the demure Maria. I didn't understand these sorts of tableaus back then, or the nuanced impressions we'd been coached to construct. Still, though, I liked it. I liked it when my parents were happy. It made me feel happy, too. In Cincinnati, we flew kites in a nearby field. My father was especially good at navigating the wind. His kite flying, unlike the other dads in the park, was far more graceful. Somehow he made it appear as though the kites themselves were outlining the edges of faraway clouds. If there was a pocket of wind, my father would find it. No one could get a kite to rise faster or climb higher than he could. In Cincinnati, my dad grilled hamburgers over charcoal and read us stories at bedtime, mostly Maurice Sendak's classic, Where the Wild Things Are. No matter how many times he read it, he never failed to growl like a wild thing and always laughed when the wild rumpus began. We had a swing set there, and for the first time, neighbors with kids the same ages as we were. Our days of communing among Florida retirees were in the rear view, and our new life in Cincinnati felt like a kind of Shangri-La, a strange-sounding word I began to hear my parents use often. We went to the Barnum and Bailey Circus and the Ice Capades, productions my parents enjoyed for different reasons. My father grew up watching the circus performers practice in their off-season in Sarasota, and never outgrew his fondness for the greatest show on earth. My mother, a fan of cold weather activity, enjoyed the grace and romance of the paired dancers moving in effortless synchronicity across the freshly smoothed ice. We attended occasional Broadway productions of Jesus Christ Superstar, of Fiddler on the Roof, and the musical stage performance of Hair, the timely production of the counterculture currently sweeping the country. During our tenure in Cincinnati, Ohio, we were living in the age of Aquarius. Our devout young mother wore hip huggers and bell bottoms, and sometimes her father would quote the hombres walking through the house saying things like, "Let it all hang out," for no reason. The Flying Purple People Eater played on the stereo in our living room, along with the music of Bob Dylan, Cat Stevens, and the Beatles. My parents bought the soundtracks of the musicals we attended, and eventually a few of us, mostly just Mary and I, would reenact parts of the performance, corralling our many younger brothers, our younger siblings, to serve as our built-in audience. All these years later, the lyrics remain like a loop in my head. I'm going to pause there, and I will pick up at another episode. Good golly. You know, it's, that's the challenge. You know, you try to, that's the challenge with memory. You know, memory is fluid, and, you know, memoir is a collection of memories. And if you ask, you know, I have 12 siblings. If you ask them, you know, their memories, they will be nothing like my own because their memories are theirs. They lived in a different time. They were different ages. But what is great about, about, writing a memoir from a creative perspective is that you have an opportunity to create narrative, to build a narrative for the sake of the story. So I have enjoyed this challenge from that perspective, and I welcome anyone else's pursuit of such. At the same time, when you are saying things currently that are as they are true, I challenge that, and there's a difference between, between memoir and memoir, or writing a memoir, and there's a difference between memory and constructing a memoir and, sort of adjusting narrative for the sake of a story. That's one thing. But to report on certain things as though they were factual, that is something different. But again, people do that. But just as they do it, so do I, and those will come along in future episodes. But I am tired of talking. I am very parched. And so I will say, TTYL, thank you so much for tuning in. Until the next time, ladies and gents, thank you so much. Bye bye.